Rebellion politics, the opposite of what you know is politics. When corporate capital makes the government break their promise, it's a new day where people create the policy. The economy trickles up to eradicate the poverty. So get up, stand up, these are our demands. What? We want our money back, so politicians, get your hands up. Equal distribution of the land and the profits, an end to all war and a socialized democracy.
Welcome to Truth Jihad Radio. This is Kevin Barrett, bringing you all sorts of interesting guests with a lot to say that isn't being sufficiently heard in the corporate mainstream. We have a special interest in looking at the issues of authority, illegitimate and legitimate. What makes authority legitimate? What gives some people the right to have power over others? Is it sheer psychopathy? That's how it seems to work in our world sometimes. Then there's also the issue of earned authority. Some folks maybe deserve to have it. Some people deserve to wear the badges. And the United States of America was set up by folks who believed that a certain kind of moral and intellectual elite would have to act as stewards of the nation. Well, today our nation has terrible stewards, and authority is being abused everywhere you look, and perhaps nowhere more obviously than in the police departments. Here in Madison, Wisconsin, we've had a number of police shootings. Most notoriously, Tony Robinson was killed on March 6th in Madison, Paul Heenan in 2012. All over the country, this has become a huge scandal. Eric Harris just being shot supposedly by mistake by a cop who was supposedly reaching for his taser after Harris was down. That video is brand new. And in July of last year, Eric Garner in New York was choked to death for selling cigarettes. In Ferguson, Missouri, Michael Brown was shot down August 9th. In November, protests erupted all over the country. And two police officers were shot in Ferguson on March 11th. It looks like we're having a serious problem with our policing. And my guest today is perhaps the best person to talk about that with. David Cooper was the police chief in Madison while I was going to school there as an undergraduate in the 1970s. And he was justly famous for having taken over an out-of-control department that was smashing the heads of peaceful protesters and doing all sorts of crazy things, and quickly turning it around and making it a model for the country. Well, it looks like the country hasn't followed the model. I don't know why not. Let's ask David. David, what's happening to our police?
Well, I think I'm as outraged as anyone is. I am really saddened by this happening, and I think, you know, having, you know, worked in the police field for over 30 years and then spending another two decades, you know, looking at police and writing about them, I think I've got this, I've got this 50-year perspective. And being a cop on the beat in the 60s of Minneapolis during the Civil Rights Movement, people thought that was a rough time for police, but I don't think it has ever been as bad as it is right now. And you know, whether we know more or more events, we really don't know, because the government doesn't require police shootings to be reported to a central database. So it's just what we hear and see, and what we hear and see is really too much for most of us to even stomach.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your background. You've written a book called Arrested Development: A Veteran Police Chief Sounds Off About Protest, Racism, Corruption, and the Seven Steps Necessary to Improve Our Nation's Police. And you do have some serious credentials for that. Let's hear a little bit about how you went from being a cop on the beat in Minnesota to coming to Madison, Wisconsin, and doing such an amazing job turning an out-of-control department into one of the best in the country.
Well, I think it came by, I guess best word is just waking up and paying attention. I had about a semester of college when I joined the police after I got out of the Marines, and then came the GI Bill for those of us who were in the military after Korea, and allowed me to go back to school. And I was working nights, going to school during the daytime, and working on my degree, and just living in those two worlds. And the civil rights movement going on, the anti-war movement going on, and everything around me said, you know, there's got to be a better way to do this than what we were doing.
I think
I had some ideas about, you know, police need to get closer to the people they serve, need to treat people with respect. We have to use control in our use of force. We have to be honest. We have to be transparent. And we have to be smart.
The honesty and transparency is maybe the most glaring failure, even beyond the violence, because there's a well-earned reputation in many police departments, perhaps most, if not all, in the United States, that even if most cops are pretty much normal people, they tend to band together to protect abuses, even committed by really bad cops. And, you know, the departments that investigate themselves with their, what do they call it? They have these various kinds of places that you're supposed to go if you've had a problem with an officer. And those internal investigations seem to consistently exonerate officers who've done the most outrageous things. How can you change that culture of impunity?
Well, it starts by who you hire. You've got to hire educated people who are probably maybe a little older, have some life experience, and you've got to start them off by saying what the job is, how important honesty is. You're expected to obey the law when you're enforcing the law, and when you can get enough people inside the organization who will actually blow the whistle on other people who aren't following the rules, then you've got things going on in the public's favor. The problem is the blue culture is so incredibly powerful. It's hard to step outside that. Frank Serpico just did a piece talking about characters from the 70s, and he talked about the business of lying. He said when he was in the New York department, the word was called, it wasn't to testify, it was to test a lie, and he called it test a lying, as a way in which information was maneuvered into, you know, the police interest against the suspect. And then if we look at the Walter Scott shooting in North Charleston, and many of us look at that and say, if that person had not taken that video, that the kind of reports that normally come in and some of the things that North Charleston did at the beginning of this whole thing was that the officer would have been exonerated, because all he would have had to have said was the magic words, and that is, I feared for my life. And therefore, the law says I can take another person's life. And that comes out of Graham v. Connor, a U.S. Supreme Court decision now back in 1989. But the point is, police have to understand that just because they can do something, they have to ask themselves, is this the moral, is this the right thing to do? Because if you can take a life in these situations, why would you want to if you could do something else other than taking another person's life? That is, if you were committed to what I think is important for our nation's police to be committed to, and that is, you know, we are the life protectors. We believe in the sanctity of human life, and we'll do everything we can do to save a life.
Well, that makes sense to me. You know, and the issue of saying that you feared for your life so you can take another life really does tie into the question of not only honesty, that is, did the officer actually genuinely fear for his life, but also, did he have a good reason to or not? Maybe he feared for his life because he's just, you know, hyped up on coffee and donuts and paranoid and scared of young black men. I mean, that seems like...
That's right. Frightened, you know. Frightened people who are scared, people who cannot comfortably work in a multiracial, cosmopolitan environment shouldn't be police today, period. They just shouldn't. This is, you know, we have a very great society that as a highlight is that our diversity, our multiculturalism, and the police that work in that can't be afraid of one group of people or the other. It's dangerous for the public. It's also dangerous for the officer. He or she shouldn't work that kind of job unless they're comfortable and are comfortable with de-escalating situations, managing conflict, backing off, taking cover. Let's see, is this a situation I want to shoot somebody or not?
Right. And I would really hope the answer would be not in any possible, if there's any other way to do it. I mean, guns are they've got to be the last resort, and yet it seems like in many cases they're almost the first resort.
Well, exactly. You know, it is also the case that, and I know this is anecdotal on my part, but from my experience, you know, police who get involved in shootings, that's just about the end of their career. Mm-hmm. First of all, I never, when I was back on the street, I never wanted to work with a fellow officer who was involved in one or more shootings, because I was afraid of one of two things was going to happen. Either he would shoot too quickly, or he wouldn't shoot at all. Mm-hmm. So it really put me at danger in working with those guys. But then I don't have data to back that up. I know, you know, that's just my experience.
Right. Well, you know, the first police shooting here in Madison that really got people's attention was when Paul Heenan was killed, and he was a friend of a good friend of mine. In fact, my friend had just seen Paul before he left wherever he left after imbibing too much alcohol, and wandered up to the wrong house, and the people called the police, and the guy showed up, shot him down under still somewhat mysterious circumstances, but it to me it doesn't look good.
And because of that shooting, then those folks, and probably many of them you know and I know that live on the Near East Side, that were very concerned about the Heenan shooting, have now partnered with the Robinson family and those who knew the Robinson young man.
And it's interesting that, you know, Paulie Heenan was a musician. He's a white guy, and I understand that Tony Robinson was kind of from a multiracial background. In both cases, these guys were apparently impaired. Heenan from drinking, and Tony Robinson from eating magic mushrooms. But you kind of have to ask yourself, in some of these situations, were these guys really that big a threat? I mean, if somebody called me and said, okay, there's this out of control guy who's, you know, drunk, he's had too much to drink, or he's taken too many mushrooms, and, you know, we know him and he's normally okay, but, you know, can you help out? I would feel like I would have no problem trying to help out, and I wouldn't take a gun, you know? Why do these people end up shot?
Well, I don't know what happened to the Robinson shooting. That report is not out yet. I do know something. I've talked with a few officers, and I've seen the reports on the Heenan shooting. And, you know, if there's one thing that I thought that we knew how to do, being police in a college town, was how to handle drunks.
Right? No kidding.
I mean, that's, I guess,
half the
job. One thing that you learn in police work is, you know, your number one conflict situation is handling a drunk. And the second one is someone who's intoxicated by other chemicals other than alcohol. I mean, that's kind of what urban police do. Mm-hmm. So we should be very good at doing that. The second thing, and we haven't talked about here, is how do police handle those people who are mentally ill, mm-hmm. without, in many cases, what seems to me, if you look at a few of these YouTube shootings, is almost the execution of someone who's mentally ill or disturbed, who's got an edged weapon, and there's, you know, police are standing around, and there was even a shooting just like that in Times Square, where that one man with a knife was chased down the street, and then shot, you know, rather than using other methods. I think we're more skilled today, and we have, you know, we understand that our verbal and our emotional intelligence is the most important thing about doing police work, because that's what 90% of police work is. It's just using your head, being able to negotiate situations, getting people to be calm, and preserving the peace. That's what police do. And even if you look at encounters now, I was, before I got into supervision, excuse me, I was about 10 years on the street on the tactical squad. And you know, maybe my memory doesn't suit me, but sure, you know, I got into a lot of scuffles and arresting people, but I can't remember where somebody was interested in hurting me as much as they were in getting away from me. Mm-hmm. That is, that they didn't want to be arrested, and I needed to arrest them.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, maybe that situation has changed today. I don't know. Police say it's a lot more dangerous out there, but, you know, if I look at the data over the years, you know, consistent, it's been pretty consistent, and police officers killed in line of duty about 150 a year, and about half of them die in traffic accidents, not as at the hands of an assailant.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, so, it's not up there with coal mining or anything.
Yeah, well, actually the top three are loggers, fishers, and pilots, and police are about 15th.
Mm-hmm. Which isn't to say that they're...
It's not the most dangerous job in America. Yes, yeah. It is dangerous,
mm-hmm.
but there are ways to make it less dangerous, and that is your skill as an officer makes your job a lot less dangerous.
Mm-hmm. You know, you mentioned that the biggest problem with suspects is often the fact that they want to get away, not so much that they want to hurt you. And it looks to me like in a lot of cases, people are being shot just for not instantly obeying orders. And like with Paul Heenan, my interpretation of the most likely thing that happened is that probably this officer ordered him to stop, put his hands up, and Heenan kind of drunkenly just lurched or something, you know, didn't obey orders. And that officer had a history of firing wildly in a parking garage because somebody wouldn't stop and obey orders and was trying to get away by driving.
Yeah.
So, and I see a lot of these other examples like this, where it looks like there are these kind of authoritarian cops who, like, if you don't do exactly what they say, they think they have the right to shoot you.
Yeah. All you have to do is scare them.
Yeah.
So what this is doing, because this is probably because of the instantaneous information we get now. You know, when I looked at the shooting of the homeless guy by four or five L.A. cops who were trying to, you know, take him out of the tent, and he should have moved his tent, and he didn't, and he grabbed the weapon of that rookie officer, and then they had to shoot him because he allegedly had. The gun of the officer, but if you look at that, I happen to see that 1 hour after it was posted on YouTube, there were 200,000 hits on that, and by the next day when I pulled up that video again, it was 2.4 million.
Yeah, it's a new world.
So police are getting many good police are getting a very very bad rap today, and whether they like it or not, they are being mistrusted. People are not giving them support, and it's making their job a lot easier. So police have to think about what they're going to do to rebuild this trust, because that is the number one question. Now, if they don't rebuild the trust, then we're going to sort of continue in two levels of policing in America. The first level is cops are nice to you because you're white and you have some means and you live in a nice neighborhood. And then there's the other side of policing, which is if you're poor, if you're an immigrant, if you are a person of color, there's another standard that's going to be applied to you. And that's not good to have that double standard policing in a democracy.
Right. Well, we're having a more and more double standard everything in this so-called democracy. Something's going to have to give at some point. But
well, there's another point in this whole thing, Kevin, which I've been, you know, kind of like in my academic days was trained to be a sociologist, so I tend to look at this sociologically. So I looked at, you know, even within Madison and Dane County, there was a great disparity. Some this recent report says it is worse in Madison and Dane County than it is in many southern states with regards to the disparities between blacks and whites.
That's right, yeah. And we see a lot of nice Madison white liberals sort of wringing their hands about it.
Yeah, yeah. And so I'm thinking back, I'm stepping back now, and I'm looking at policing, and I'm looking at some of the studies that I've done over the years when I was a student. And it comes to this. The question I have is this one. Having our nation having failed to provide equal access and opportunity for African Americans, and year after year, with high unemployment rates, with lack of access to many parts of this society, and the failure of African American students to get a high school diploma, have we not then, instead of addressing that problem, just said, let's just ramp up the police and we'll use a domination system here. We'll make sure that those people stay in line because we are either unwilling or unable to equalize this society.
Mm-hmm. It does look like that's happening. Absolutely.
And if that happens, then this will be a sad, sad time for America.
Right. Well, there's a structural issue too. I think that our good jobs for working people are gone. So it's not just African Americans, but the poorer people from all ethnic groups are having a harder and harder time making ends meet. Because when I was a kid, as I recall, the truck drivers and factory workers were making as much as a lot of college professors, and even some mid-level executives. And the pay for unskilled labor was much higher than it is today.
Exactly. And the minimum wage is not a living wage.
Right. The minimum wage the real minimum wage has been shrinking since 1960. I think it's a fraction of what it was then.
Exactly.
So there's a structural issue involving probably productivity increases. It means we don't need all that labor anymore. And then we ship our manufacturing off to Asia and to low-wage countries. And that just leaves the whole working class in the lurch here. And what are we going to do about that? Are we going to just lock them all up in prison? That's more expensive probably than finding something productive for them to do.
Well, we seem to be doing that in Wisconsin. We have the highest percentage of African-Americans in prison in the state of Wisconsin than they do in any southern state. In fact, the second highest is Oklahoma.
I didn't know that.
It is staggering. But of course, Kevin, you might ask me this. You might say, well, what are you going to do about it, Cooper?
Let's put you in charge of the commission that's going to give us the solution.
So I've identified in my book some steps that police need to take. In fact, there's a nice seven of them. But I would say right now, and this is what I've been preaching. Police leaders, they need to stand up and say, we hear you. We hear that you don't want us to shoot unarmed people. We hear you. We understand your pain. We don't want to do this either. We believe in the protection and sanctity of life, and we're going to change this system. Because what is happening today is we can't just look at bad cops. I don't think it's bad cops anymore. I think it's bad system. And the system has got to change, and we've got to start training police to be more careful and cautious when they use deadly force. Other nations do that. No one shoots in the free world as much as we do. So I think there's work that can be done here, and that these police leaders can stand up and say, we've done these things, and you could judge us on our product here. And at the same time, we pledge to treat everybody with dignity and respect, because a lot of the resistance and a lot of the anger and pain we're hearing from African Americans today is because their encounters with police, they've been disrespected and they've had their dignity stripped away. And when you strip away a person's dignity, they get very, very angry. So there's got to be an authentic respect for people on our nation's police. And that's, it's got to be all like, what is there, 600,000 police in tens of thousands of police departments. But it's up to the police leaders, their professional associations, their unions to stand up and say, we are going to be better.
Like, I read about, wasn't there a borough in New York where they did some kind of pilot program where it was a really bad neighborhood and the police made a point of kind of befriending people, and especially they targeted the people who were the biggest problems, the big guys, and they went and gave them a turkey on Thanksgiving, and basically made friends with the most troublesome people, and the crime kind of evaporated. I don't know if that would happen everywhere, but it sure does show you that you treat people like human beings.
In poor crime-ridden neighborhoods, want the same as what rich white people want in their neighborhoods, and that is they want a peaceful neighborhood. They want an environment where their kids can succeed and are respected. We all want the same thing. So when police move into those neighborhoods, to be part of that neighborhood and to work with those neighborhood associations and people. They get all kinds of support because they couldn't say community-oriented policing. I like to call it neighborhood-oriented policing because I think that's at the level we need to work. When people see police are there to stay and they care about the neighborhood and they're willing to work with citizens and helping that become a better neighborhood, things happen for the better.
And this would require a kind of a change in policing personality to happen on a large scale. And, you know, one of the ways to possibly nudge this along that I thought about was teaching police to meditate. There's a woman named Rafina Anclasaria down in Ferguson or near Ferguson who was on the show a few months ago. And she's had great results teaching prisoners to meditate. She does a sort of a spinoff on TM, but I think different meditation modes all probably work. I do Sufi meditation. And she greatly lowered the recidivism rate. And it occurred to me and to her when we had the discussion on the show that maybe police should be meditating because this, you know, meditation raises the threshold of the stress that you can handle before you snap and makes you less fearful, less aggressive. So, you know, maybe the problem is just the prisoners.
My assistant for many years was a young woman, Sherry Maples, she rose to the rank of a captain on the police department. She has a law degree. After her retirement, she worked in the correctional department and as an assistant attorney general in the state of Wisconsin. She has subsequently become a Dharma teacher for the Thich Nhat Hanh school of Buddhism. She actually did a workshop a few years ago where Thich Nhat Hanh was here, primarily with police and meditation, and also understanding the pain that a lot of police officers have and the violence that they see and just in the normal aspects of their job and how healing that was for the police that attended that weekend.
Yeah, I just talked to a neighbor who's a retired state trooper. He said that a whole lot of state troopers, probably, you know, a huge number of them here in Wisconsin, don't live that long to collect their quite decent retirement pay because the job was so stressful that they end up having unhealthy lifestyles and all kinds of stress and fear in their lives. And then, you know, heart attacks, strokes, some cancer takes them away. And, you know, he was describing how that could be changed by working on the schedules, the work schedules, the conditions. He said that was half the problem, was they're working them too much, not getting enough rest.
So I say it at the end of my book, what is it that would have liked to done better or done differently? And I wrote that if I had to do it over again, I would have been more involved in the emotional life of my police officers. That is, you know, tragedies that happened in their families, divorces, those kind of major events that could happen in a person's life. And I was happy to see that the President's Commission on the Task Force on 21st Century Policing had a recommendation that I was very much in favor, say not only having, looking at the healthy lifestyles for police officers, but have annual health and physical assessments, including mental health assessments.
Right.
So I think we, you know, which is exactly what your neighbor was talking about, we should be more concerned about being able to support good mental health behaviors and off-duty activities and things of our police officers. I mean, they're pretty important in society. They have this massive amount of authority, and they carry guns. So we should be helping people like that.
Absolutely. Well, your perspective is informed by spirituality. You're a priest in the Episcopal Church. As I recall, you practice meditation, right?
Yes. I'm very much in favor of that. In time of people taking reflection, I'm also a big supporter of people, you know, at least once a year taking a weekend or a week long retreat, and hopefully with a lot of silence and a lot of personal reflection on one's life. I think that's very, very important. I think probably my, I wasn't always a person of faith, but I had a strong belief in the importance and dignity and I guess sacredness of the human person, and that certainly rolled into when I had this call to ordain ministry, because I think a lot of the work I'm doing right now and maintaining this blog on improving police and the books that I've written is to try to work with, if I can do something for social justice in our nation, it would be, first thing I would choose would be to improve our police, because they are the gatekeepers to so many systems in our nation today. Not only just criminal justice, but the mental health care systems, helping people who are new immigrants to this country. Police can be a force of being a guardian, kind of like the guardian that Plato talked about in his Republic, and also a protector rather than the sort of de facto role that they've kind of slid into, that of being a warrior, and this militarism, which is another part of policing today that's, I think, driven a lot of this shooting problem, is that too many police consider themselves to be warriors rather than guardians and protectors of people.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that Platonic conception of guardian, because that's come under scrutiny from some new angles recently. There's a new book out that's a collection of scholarly articles about state crimes against democracy. And there's a wonderful article by Lance DeHaven Smith, who's a professor in Florida, arguing that so-called conspiracy theories about certain kinds of political offense, especially assassinations and war trigger events, our understanding is starting to change as we become aware that there is a kind of guardian class at work in the national security community that has taken it upon itself to be above the law in matters of war and peace. And that's every major war since the Mexican War has been launched with some kind of orchestrated or fabricated alleged enemy attack. With the Mexican invasion that didn't happen, remember the Maine when that was blown up in a false flag, the Lusitania was sent into the path of U-boats, the Zimmerman telegram that the Germans are going to invade America was forged, Gulf of Tonkin, Pearl Harbor, and now of course 9/11 in Iraqi WMD. It's the standard method for starting wars. And then if there's a peacenik president like JFK or his peacenik brother RFK, they shoot him down, and they shot down Martin Luther King for the same reason, etc. etc. So this Lance DeHaven Smith is arguing that there's a kind of guardian class run amok that's gotten really not just above the law and doing things that they think are necessary for national security, even though they're illegal and immoral from a certain perspective, but they're out of control. They're demonstrably making extremely wrong moves.
Let me say when I say guardian, I think of the most well-educated, the best and brightest should become our guardians, and that they are responsible directly to the people, and sort of the concept that Robert Peel had over 150 years ago when he established the first democratic police department in London, when he wrote that the police are the people and the people are the police, that connection. And that's why I'm a big believer in neighborhood or community-oriented policing, because it implies to me a very strong connection between the people whom the police serve and that interaction between the two, and willing to work together, that both sides need to work together to make this the fabric of this society work.
And then there's the question of who will guard the guardians. Wherever, anytime you have guardians, you hope the guardians will be the good Platonic guardians who are really devoting their lives to the betterment of the society.
There's our test as a people, right?
Right. But if you need a system to guard the guardians just in case they start running amok, as they have been in this country, and so would police accountability boards that were genuinely dedicated to guarding the guardians work?
Yeah. Well, if you look at the history of, police review boards, police accountability boards, it's not a very happy history. I mean, they really don't do well. There's a few examples where the the review board actually had representatives from people who were being policed, predominantly people of color and who are poor. But for the most part, you know, those jobs are given to, you know, people who are politically connected and so forth. I think the only way we're really going to have a high accountable police department is that we have to have highly accountable individual police officers who are committed to the values of this society.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, among your seven steps, the selecting the finest and the brightest to serve as police officers and then having police officers listen to the community seem to me to be two of the really crucial ones. In terms of the listening to the community, what are some ways that could be sort of institutionalized, that, you know, to have that as a normal thing? You don't wait until some kind of Michael Brown shooting happens before the police sit down and listen to the people who don't feel happy about the way they're being policed.
Well, I argue in my book, and there are better methods today than there was when I was police chief. We had to send out letters and self-addressed stamped envelopes where I literally asked people, and I randomly selected every 50th case number, sent out a personal letter with a rating scale as how was your contact with police. And that included people who were arrested, people who were given tickets, people who reported crimes, people who were victims of crimes, people who were witnesses. And that gave me a sense of how my officers were doing. And, you know, it's easy to, as a chief of police, to get isolated out there. That was a very important connection. I got the officers to buy in on this because I said, and I very clearly said in the letter, I said to the citizen, this is not, if you want to make a complaint about a police officer specifically and you want some justice, this is not the forum. We have an internal affairs department. I'm interested in knowing, you know, the quality of the encounter you had with one of my officers. So now today, I mean, what we could do with things like SurveyMonkey and all kinds of ways in which we get immediate feedback, I think it's absolutely essential. Police leaders have to know how their people are doing out there, and you can't wait for some incident to happen to have it blow up in your face.
Do you have any specific memories of situations where you talked with one of your officers about interactions with the public, both positive and negative?
Well, I do remember it was the first surveys to come back to me. A citizen wrote in and identified the officer by name and said that that he was taking 2-hour lunch breaks at his house. This was an officer who had been a thorn in my side for many, many years. And this was an opportunity for me to really twist his tail a bit, but I couldn't do it. I had done that, I would have lost the faith of the department that I was true to my word, that this was not going to be used for discipline. It would have blown the whole thing up, so I just had to swallow it.
Oh, wow, that must have been tough.
but see, for the most part, it also happened when I would appear at council meetings, and then over a 6-year period, we showed when we started, you know, decentralizing the department, giving officers more responsibility to work with the community, that our satisfaction rate went up every single year. So when I would get, you know, maybe a council person who didn't like me would say something like, well, you know, chief, I've been hearing a lot of complaints about your officers, and I don't think you're doing a very good job out there. I'd say, well, I'm really sorry you feel that way, Alderman, but you know, our latest data that we have from the field indicating that the people, in fact, people in your district, because we could find out, ask people where they lived, but people in your districts are very happy with their police services. But if you have something individual, you can talk to me about it. So it helped me kind of counter that, kind of like, well, you know, people are mad at the police and having no data, and I had some data.
Mm-hmm.
So that's simply not true. That's not what's going on out there.
Yeah, with the internet, you think it would be pretty easy to set up feedback systems.
And I think the thing that really, you know, and I wrote a piece of this on my blog. I actually, for the first time in my career, I went to the funeral of a person the police had killed. I've been to lots of police funerals over the course, more than I want to remember, where police officers have been killed in duty. This was the first time I ever went to a victim's funeral, and it was right here in my hometown, and I was overwhelmed with the intensity of the grief and the anger at the young people who were assembled at that funeral. It shook me to the bone, and I think it's probably driven me more than ever to keep on, I keep on writing and keep on saying, please, you've got to stop killing unarmed people. Stop killing unarmed people. Stop killing unarmed people. And the pushback I get is that, well, you don't understand how hard it is out there, Chief. You know, you're out of touch. And I say, no, wait a second. You know, I worked through the civil rights movement. I never had a personal radio. The radio was in the car. When you're out of the car, you're on your own. We didn't have bulletproof vests. We had six-shot revolvers. And I never detected the anger and just the raw anger from the black community in the 1960s that I'm sensing is going on in America right now.
Do you think
I think it's far, far beyond that.
Do you think part of the issue is that these 9/11 wars sent all kinds of kids over, you know, fired up and angry about 9/11, which led to all kinds of abuses in Iraq and Afghanistan? You know, probably a lot of that stuff was going on in Vietnam too. In any case, they come home and the vets get jobs as cops, and they're training to view the people they deal with as kind of all enemies. And their paranoia and their, you know, fear factor, adrenaline that, you know, came with their jobs in the military is getting transferred into policing. And then the militarization of police through all the tanks and the howitzers and the helicopter gunships. And it's like we're turning into an internal occupation force.
Exactly. So soldiers are to meet and kill the enemy. That's their job. It's nothing to do with how police are. Police are to protect and serve the public, and those two jobs are legions away from one another. I was in the Marines for 4 years on active duty and another 6 years in the reserve, and there was very little that I learned as a Marine, and even being a security guard aboard a naval aircraft carrier, nothing except that I could shoot a weapon with probably greater accuracy than people who hadn't been in the military.
Well, you know, I know a bunch of ex-Marines who were very, very cool people. I joke about there being a Smedley Butler brigade of ex-Marines.
Look at Smedley Butler,
Now, that's my idea of a military hero, a guy who's approached by the DuPont family to lead a coup d'etat and establish a fascist dictatorship, and he could be the dictator, and he blows the whistle to Congress. Now, I don't know why they don't tell us this in the high school history books.
No, we don't want to hear that story, and that is a decorated Marine general who was anti-war.
Right. Well, and today there are some fantastic ex-Marines out there, like Ken O'Keefe. He's a good friend and a true hero. He actually renounced his U.S. citizenship because he was so upset about the unjust wars. And I don't know how much you've studied this, but since World War II, according to Chomsky and Volchek's book on Western terrorism, we've killed about 60 million people worldwide in military and CIA interventions, sanctions, and basically aggressive activities all over the world, and ruined the lives of hundreds of millions as well. So Ken couldn't stomach that, and he left the country and turned in his citizenship badge. Gordon Duff runs Veterans Today, where I write. He's a former military intelligence insider who was pushed over the edge by the CIA involvement in the drug trade and 9/11 and all of that. And Jim Fetzer here in Madison.
That's the reason a number of years ago why I joined Veterans for Peace.
Did you run into that issue of the...
We've got a chapter here in Madison, committed to doing counter-counseling in high schools when the military comes in and tries to recruit rural Wisconsin kids to join, and we have members of our unit who go in there and talk about the other side of the story.
Right. And are the high schools good about giving you equal access?
Well, we've had some battles, but we've won most of them.
Right. Yeah, I find it kind of mind-boggling that the military, you know, PR flacks are given carte blanche to just go into the schools and present this insanely one-sided picture. And hardly anybody who actually joins and gets shipped over to Afghanistan or Iraq is likely to say that the experience matched the expectations that they had from the recruiter. That's for sure.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, there is a connection though between the police problems and these occupations, because, you know, as you said, the job of the military is to fight and kill the enemy. But when you're invading and occupying somebody's country, the enemy is basically everybody in the country because nobody wants to be occupied. If the Chinese ever came and invaded our country, we wouldn't want to be occupied either. So basically an occupation force is not just killing the enemy. They're there to fight and kill everybody, you know, everybody who's willing to stand up for the independence of their own country. And that's what you become.
They talk about the danger of using terms like war on crime or war on drugs is a very dangerous phrase to use to tell police that they're engaging in a war against drugs or a war against crime.
Yeah, talk a little bit about the war on drugs, quote unquote, terrible metaphor. I think that was one of the issues that you dealt with in the 70s.
Just absolute. It has probably led to more corruption, probably as bad as the prohibition. The interesting thing is, if you look at the spikes in police officers being killed in the line of duty, was during prohibition, which was the highest, and the second next spike in that was during our so-called war on drugs.
Interesting. And yeah, the gang violence that is all around the drug trade seems to be one of the key factors in giving everybody this sense of extreme insecurity, big guns everywhere, semi-automatic and automatic weapons floating around. No wonder the police are scared, and this is all because of this neo-prohibition.
It would be nice if we could all disarm. If everybody, let's just put our guns in a big pile and ask the police to do that, and let's try it for a while.
Now, that sounds like a thought. Now, the problem, though, is that, again, who will guard the guardians is, you know, I'm not a huge gun enthusiast, but I've come around to respecting a lot of the pro-Second Amendment people just because the guardians have gotten so bad that I have to wonder whether if we have more and more gun control preventing ordinary folks from having these weapons, and meanwhile the corrupt and illicit authorities are stockpiling bigger and bigger weapons, that might lead to an even worse world than if both sides are armed. I don't know.
Yeah.
Have you thought about
that? Oh, then we could talk about drones too, and that would be
What are police departments doing with drones?
Well, there could be, you know. I mean, if you're the sheriff out in Arapahoe County or someplace out there with 40,000 square miles, and it's a camping area, and people, you know, get lost every once in a while. I mean, it would be nice to have a drone, mm-hmm. to find the kid or something. Now there are some legitimate uses, but on the other hand, you know, once they're permitted, it's easy to arm those drones. It's very easy to put surveillance equipment on them. I mean, it's a scary thought in terms of personal liberties. So it's up to the police. You would think that if they're guardians, they would be saying, "Well, let's be careful here about these things. Let's be very careful, and let's talk about the kind of controls and, you know, how we're going to be accountable in using them." And yeah, it's not coming. It's here.
And it's a step towards this automation of warfare and so many other things. You know, there are self-driving cars now in Silicon Valley, apparently.
Yeah, that's right.
And they're going to force that on us because they're going to say that human error is the cause of a lot of the deaths on the road. And so if we just have these computers driving cars, we will lower the death rate. and you're going to have to, you know, from now on, you're not going to be able to drive your car anymore. And, you know, I'm seeing this kind of thing everywhere where our devices are really taking over from us. I actually did an interview with David Skrbina, who's a philosophy professor and publishes the Unabomber's writing. And David is a very sweet and nonviolent soul, but he agrees with Ted Kaczynski about the way technology is completely out of control. You see that with like policing and military technologies leading us down a path towards losing control over our lives and having a degraded culture?
Yeah, there's a lot of warning signs out there.
Right. Yeah, the drones in particular really bother me, that, you know, these drone killings, which it looks like they're killing a whole lot of non-combatants for every combatant. It's being done like it's like playing a video game. These guys sitting in trailers and, you know, flying some drone, killing a bunch of people at a wedding party halfway around the world. And this is some kind of supposedly defensible, valorous activity. This is defending our country. I mean, you know, seems like we've really, really gone down the wrong path. And what could it take to turn things around in a big way? I mean, the reason that I'm doing what I'm doing now instead of teaching religious studies or literature somewhere is that when it dawned on me that David Ray Griffin and other researchers were right about 9/11 having been a false flag event, and not just that, but it's easy to see it. You know, 3 minutes looking at Building 7 coming down and the landlord, Larry Silverstein, confessing to it, and you know that. So theoretically, I thought that if we forced the country to confront this atrocious and shocking fact, that the shock effect might actually undo a lot of these bad trends that we're undergoing, you know. But I don't know. I mean, so that's been my particular hobby horse on something that might change the world. I've been working on that and related issues. But, you know, that's not the only possibility. There are all sorts of ways that this sliding towards dictatorship and Orwellian fascism could possibly change. Do you have any ideas about?
Well, I think that one of the things that we really have to do is to try to give citizens some direction and tools and something that they can do other than sit back and just complain about how the world is going to hell in a handbasket. There are things that we can help citizens. I'm talking about, you know, what to do about the police is on my blog. I said this is how police should be. This is what they should do, and I've written a little monograph on how to rate your local police with a checklist, and said take that to your department and talk about it. Where are the police falling down? Where are they good at? How can you support them and the good things they're doing, and how can you help them change to be better? So I think it means an engagement in something that's very difficult for people, because the police tend to be very isolated and non-transparent, is to engage in starting a dialogue with your police. Their job is to talk to you and to help meet your needs. So we need to have those dialogues going on in every city, in every neighborhood, and to ask police to be accountable and to be better.
How would an ordinary citizen start a dialogue with police?
Well, I'm a great believer in neighborhood associations. They're kind of the forte of Madison and many other cities, and that discussion can begin at the neighborhood level. A bunch of neighbors getting together with the police that work in your area and talking about this, and then inviting the police commander of the area, even the police chief, to come and talk about these things. And in kind of a community organizing sense, is that ask them to make promises of what they're going to do, and then have a recheck time where the police will come back to the neighborhood and say, okay, you've told us about these things that need fixing. I want to report now how we've been able to do this. And we need your support. And you develop that kind of a relationship that I think is so absolutely critical and is very absent from most of our cities today.
And do you think that people who are out there monitoring police with video cameras like Cop Watch and Blue Badges, ShinyBadges.com, those kind of people have a role to play in this dialogue?
Well, I think so. I mean, where would we be? It would be interesting. If we excluded the video footage from smartphones, if we took all that off the internet, the police would look pretty good.
Yeah, so maybe all that's really changed is we're actually seeing what's going on now.
Well, some people have suggested that. I don't know. I'm more of a data person. The President's Commission recommended that there be legislation requiring reporting of police shootings of citizens, and we have some idea about who's getting shot, their age, race, sex, and what was the incident that led to their demise. Get that kind of data out here, and then we'll be able to talk a little bit more rationally about it. But
isn't that amazing that they're not keeping that right now?
There's no FBI data. It's voluntary.
Yeah.
And the largest police department in the United States, New York City and New York, does not require that reporting to go to the federal government. I mean, it's like, wow.
Right. So there's some obvious steps for some at least partial fixes. And I like the idea of the community and neighborhood groups meeting with police and vice versa. To me, that's one that really could make a difference. It did happen in that one precinct of New York. I forget the details of that particular episode, but it's kind of a no-brainer. You know, treat people with respect as human beings, and the relationship will work out a lot better than if you act like an army of occupation. Well, thank you so much, David Cooper. I think we've hit the end of the hour, but I've been admiring your work for 30 plus years now, and I think your wisdom is probably needed now more than ever. So your book is called Arrested Development, and your website is davidcooper.com, davidcooper.com. I'll link that at the Truth Jihad Radio.
David C. Cooper.
There's an extra C in there. Okay. David C. Cooper.
And my blog is called Improving Police on WordPress.com.
Okay. The Improving Police blog. Well, thank you so much for helping improve police
Keep up the good work here. This is important stuff you're doing.
I appreciate it. Likewise.
Thank you. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
In this prison of seclusion, happiness living on the streets is a delusion. Even a smooth criminal one day must get caught. Shot up or shot down with the bullet that he bought. 9mm kicking, thinking about what the streets do to me. Cause they never taught peace in the black community. All we know is violence, do the job in silence. Walk the city streets like a rat pack of tyrants. Too many brothers daily headed for the big pen. Niggas coming out worse off than when they went in. Over the years I've done a lot of growing up. Get drunk, throwing up, cuffed up. Then I said I had enough. There must be another route, way out to money and fame. I changed my name, played a different game. Tired of being trapped in this vicious cycle. If one more cop harasses me, I just might go psycho. And when I get him, I hit him with a bum rush. Only a lunatic would like to see a skull crush. Yo, if you're smart, you'll really let me go cheap. But keep me cooped up in this ghetto and catch the Uzi. They got me trapped. They got me trapped.
Nah, they can't keep the black man down.
Trapped.
They can't keep the black man down.
Trapped.
Nah, they can't keep the black man down.
They got me trapped. Can barely walk the city streets without a cop harassing me, searching me, then asking my identity. Hands up, throw me up against the wall. Didn't do a thing at all. Telling you one day these suckers gotta fall. Cuffed up, throw me on the concrete. Tried to kill me, but they didn't know this was the wrong streak. Bang, bang, count another casualty. But it's a cop who shot for his brutality. Who do you blame? It's a shame because the man's slain. He got caught in the chains of his own gang. How can I feel guilty after all the things they did to me? Sweated me, hunted me, trapped in my own community. One day I'm gonna bust, blow up on this society. Why did you lie to me? I couldn't find a trace of equality. Work me like a slave while they laid back. Homie, don't play that. It's time I let them suffer the payback. I'm trying to avoid physical contact. I can't hold back.